There's actually several seats down the bottom here. If anyone wants to come downstairs, there are about five or six really nice seats there. Is everyone all right at the top there? It looks a bit of a jumble up there, really. Anyway, I think I have to, if you don't mind, start in spite of the fact there's a bit of a melee upstairs that people downstairs can't see. Can I just say thanks to everyone for coming again this week. Much appreciated by me. In this lecture, I'm going to pursue some of the themes that I introduced in the first lecture, because although the first lecture was about globalization, the debate about globalization is really the backdrop to all of these lectures. Because if you remember my argument, it was that globalization is a single term for a lot of changes. Those changes are paradoxical, contradictory. They should actually, rather than just talking about, as it were, the world becoming more integrated or something like that, we should really talk about basic shifts in how our world is and what our world is like. And these shifts include not just changes in the structures of the world, but changes in our inner consciousness, ourselves, our own identities, and very personal type changes bound up with these things. Can I just start this lecture by giving you a list of happenings and ask you what they share in common? First of all, the debate about global warming. Global warming is a debate about a scientific hypothesis that there is accumulation of gases in the world's atmosphere that is increasing the temperature of the climate of the world, and is not only that, producing propensities to much greater interruptions of the world's climate. Scientists are talking not just of, for example, more hurricanes in the world, but the emergence of what are now called hypercanes. Hypercanes would be storms that are 10 times as strong as hurricanes, first example. Second, Lloyd's Insurance Company. Lloyd's Insurance Company, for like 200, 300 years, was the most stable, reckoned to be about the most stable institution in British society. And if you've ever been to the City of London, you used to have all these liveried officials standing on the steps, kind of indicating its traditional status within the country. Well, a few years ago, Lloyd's Insurance Company suddenly came to the verge of extinction and was in danger of simply becoming bankrupt. It is still possibly in danger of becoming bankrupt. If you're interested, by the way, in a book on that, it's a very interesting book written by a guy called Adam Raphael called Ultimate something or other, because I still have to fill in the something or other in the title, but a very good account of what happened at Lloyd's Insurance Company. Third example, red wine. Red wine, a few years ago, was thought to be harmful to people's health, as alcohol was generally. Now it's reckoned that, as everyone is very pleased to know, if you have a couple of glasses of red wine a day, it's supposed to be protective against heart disease, or is supposed to be protective against heart disease in people above a certain age, or is supposed to be, especially for men above a certain age, has some kind of protective consequences. So what used to be thought of as damaging now seems to be regarded by the medical profession as healthy. Fourth, pasta. Pasta used to supposedly make us fat about 30 or so years ago. People in, you know, the English being, having these ethnic prejudices, used to say, well, a lot of Italians are fat because they eat a lot of pasta. Well, they're not in fact fat, it's just an ethnic prejudice, but people in the scientific profession used to think that eating pasta made you fat. In recent years, it's been declared that eating pasta makes you thin, on the contrary. And plenty of diets, which I'm sure some people sitting in this audience will be following. They go out and eat a lot of pasta, they think it's very healthy. because eating pasta allows you to lose weight. However, now, the most recent American diet, eating pasta is wrong. If you want to lose weight on the latest American fat diet, what you do, I mean, it's not a diet that makes you fat, it's a diet that makes you thin. You eat bacon, you eat lots of steak, you eat lots of eggs, but you don't eat any pasta, you don't eat any potatoes, you don't eat any bread. So pasta seemed to make you fat, then it seemed to make you thin, and now it seems to make you fat again. Finally, genetically modified crops. Genetically modified crops have not been far from the headlines in the last year or so. And anyone, I think, interested in the issues I'm going to discuss in this lecture, or indeed more generally in the social sciences, should follow this controversy. It's a really, really interesting one, very consequential one. Only about a year ago, Monsanto, the giant food production company, among other things, agricultural chemicals company, seemed to be successfully pursuing a program of planting genetic crops across large areas in North America, China, and it was intended Europe. As everyone here will be very conscious, there's a wave of protest against this in Europe, including in this country, which Monsanto was not actually prepared for. As a result, the latest stock market quotations for Monsanto show that the agricultural chemicals division of Monsanto has lost a great deal of its value because the stock exchange or the investors think the company is not going to be so easily able to make that segment of his activities profitable. What do all these things share in common? Well, what they share in common is what was the subject of the second lecture I gave and the subject of this one today. They all concern risk. And the title of Adam Raphael's book was Ultimate Risk, so take the brackets out there. Lloyd's obviously is an insurance company, and Lloyd's business is covering risk. I've done an awful lot of work on risk myself over the last few years, and I'd like to propose to you in this lecture that the term risk is one of the most important and central terms in the social sciences today. And that once you twist it, you turn it around, you kind of open it up, it's one of the most interesting areas, really, of analysis in understanding human behavior and the structures of modern society. The notion of risk is also central to modern politics and the debates that are going on in post-socialist politics across the world. The idea of risk kind of exemplifies and gives kind of expression to some of the basic changes now going on in the world. And once you've read something on risk or heard a lecture like this on risk or listened to a talk on the radio about risk, I defy you to open the newspaper any day without finding some article that concerns risk where the term risk is actually mentioned. I think one of the things that's happened over the past 10 or so years is that risk and discussion of risk has gone from being in the inside pages and the back pages of newspapers to being on the front page. It wasn't genetically modified foods, it wasn't just BSE. This is something which has gradually happened over the past few years, indicating the increasing centrality of the notion of risk to what our lives are all about. And I'd like to propose to you in this lecture that the idea of risk now enters our lives right the way through from these different dimensions I was talking about last time, right the way through from personal experience, what it means to have a self-identity, how you relate to your body, how you relate indeed to the diversity of information you get about diet and food on the one hand, right up to the global economy, the Asian crisis, ecological problems, which are obviously in their way also risk environments. The notion of risk therefore has somehow emerged as really central to what the social sciences are all about in the late 20th century. And it's crept very much into politics because if you think about it, the welfare state is a system which is designed to protect you against risk and contingency in your life. The risk of illness, the risk of disablement, the risk of becoming unemployed, the risk of becoming divorced, the risk of course of physical cataclysms like earthquakes and so on, all to some extent covered by the state in Western countries. So There's a kind of massive extension of concern with the idea of risk going on at the moment, which is correct, because somehow the idea of risk has become so central now to what our lives are all about. Why and how should this be so? Now, you might think, when you start thinking about it, that it's just always so, because you might think risk means the same as danger or hazard, right? Because risk, risk is about some avoidable future hazard. That's what risk means. Something you don't want to happen as a result of a course of action you initiate is what you call a risk. And couldn't you therefore say that life has always been a risky business? Because you consider Thomas Hobbes on the Middle Ages, life was nasty, brutish and short, and indeed it was for lots of people. There was the fear of God, the wrath of God. There was all the unknowns about the world, all the unknowns about how things affected people in the Middle Ages, because there was very little development of science and technology. So couldn't you say that life has always been risky? Well, the answer is no, you can't. You can say that life has always been dangerous and hazardous, but danger and hazard are not the same as risk. This is really interesting if you look into the history, the etymology of the notion risk. We don't know the origins of the term risk because it's to some extent shrouded in mystery. But so far as we can tell, there was no notion of risk in the Middle Ages, except perhaps in some very marginal context of activity. People just didn't have a concept of risk. And nor, so far as we can tell, did they in most traditional cultures either. If you consider Asian cultures, for example, Japan or China, so far as I can tell, in traditional Japan, traditional China, there was not a notion of risk. Why should that be if life was always a risky business? Well, it all hinges on what the term risks means and why risk is different from hazard and danger. In the Middle Ages, people dealt with most of the phenomena that we now call risk and risk calculation in terms of explaining them as acts of God, as luck, as fortune, or as fate. The idea of fate and the idea of a cosmology of life, was the basic and interpretative system that people had in the Middle Ages, and they had the same thing in Asian civilizations. The theme of traditional civilization is basically repetition, because the tradition is so central that in, for example, traditional Chinese culture, you had a series of classical scriptures which express the eternal nature of the cosmos. And in a way, the Bible was like that, although the Bible had a more kind of vigorous relationship to the world. In the Middle Ages, you didn't have a concept of risk because you didn't need a concept of risk. It's the simplest way to explain it. The idea of risk only develops when you have a society which actively tries to break away from the past and to conquer the future. So the rise of the idea of risk and the introduction of the very concept of risk comes from the development of modern industrial civilization, beginning way back in something like the 17th century or so, when for the first time really in human history, Western civilization, dominated by some of the notions I discussed last time, technology, science, progress, shaping the world to human interests, refusing to accept that the world is given by God, and starting to believe that we can make our own history, we can control nature through science and technology. These were the kind of generative beliefs that fueled the expansion of Western industrial civilization. And they also fueled the kind of journeys which Western explorers made across the world. As, for example, when they made contact in Japan, the first missionaries went to Japan. It was a kind of physical process of exploration of space and a temporal process of the exploration of time. Because really, in traditional cultures, in a certain sense in which there is no notion of the future, there's no notion of risk, and there's no notion of the future as a separate temporal domain, because the future looks very much like the past. But with the rise of modernity, for the first time, you get a society which is bent on changing the future. It sees the future as a kind of domain to be colonized. The thing I mentioned last time, the Enlightenment philosophers, they saw the future as like a territory, you know, in which if you can colonize that territory, you can march in and occupy it, and you can thereby shape history to human purposes, and you get away from God, you get away from dogma, you get away from the influence of the past in order to shape the influence of the future. So the idea of risk is very much bound up with the control of time and time of the future, but it's also very much originally bound up with control of space. The term risk, so far as we can tell, seems to have come into English from Portuguese and was coined in Portuguese to describe the voyages of the European adventurers as they set off around the world in the 16th century. As the West expanded physically, the idea of risk seems first of all to have meant encountering uncharted waters. A risky area was an uncharted area of the sea. So it originally was a kind of spatial notion, but also obviously tied up with the expansion of the West across the world, but it rapidly became a temporal notion because risk as we understand it now is mainly about time. It's about how you calculate future time. So the idea of risk arises in a society which is bent on controlling the future, and that is a major break really in the history of world civilization. The notion of risk, I don't think you can stress this too strongly, is not just a negative notion. You know, if you think of health risk, for example, or the risk of eating unhealthy foods, or the risk of an earthquake, that risk seems a purely negative thing. It seems to be simply something that you should avoid or minimize as far as possible. Now, that is obviously true of some areas of risk. But there are other areas of risk, and these are central to the kind of dynamic notion of Western capitalism, where risk is a positive notion. Because risk-taking has this kind of energizing quality in people's lives. You can see that all of our lives are, you know, even our everyday lives as ordinary people, are a kind of balance between avoiding risks and taking them. No one would drive a car if they simply wanted to avoid risk, because driving a car is itself a risky business, and people get some pleasure from driving fast, even though they know that driving fast is more dangerous than driving more slowly, and the same thing applies to climbing mountains or other kinds of risk environments. But the core area where risk is a positive thing is in the economy, because the whole rationale of Western capitalism is that you try to calculate future risk, you take risk-based decisions in a climate of future opportunities. So when the famous sociologist Max Weber first started analyzing the development of Western capitalism, he gave a lot of attention to this, that Western capitalism is quite different from other kinds of economic system, Weber argued, precisely because it embeds itself in the future. And it embeds itself in the future by calculating profit and loss. And calculating profit and loss involves risk assessment. Whenever you make an investment, you're involved in risk assessment, whether you're an entrepreneur or someone selling your labor power in return for an income. Whenever you put any money in the bank, actually, you're involved in an arena of risk, even though banks seem to us safe. But of course, banks are not necessarily safe. Banks can easily go bust and have gone bust throughout the last 200 or 300 years. So the idea of the rise of risk comes about with the development of modern Western society and its attempts to control the future. And it is really a kind of mechanism of doing that. The idea of risk allowed people to control the future. It wasn't just an abstract thing. And the best book on this, one of the very best books on risk, actually, that I'm sure some people here will know, but worth reading if you don't, is Peter Bernstein, Against the Gods. Also a very good title, because that's what is involved here. You're talking of a world which is breaking away from the idea of preordained universe established by the gods. And Bernstein shows the rise of risk is associated with the rise of probability theory, mathematical theories of calculation, and all these were influenced in turn by the rise of the modern economy. In the original Portuguese, as I mentioned in the brief lecture I gave, the word risk has the root in the term to dare. You know, when you dare something, when you're bold about something, you must take risks. Risk is the medium, therefore, of a kind of dynamic approach to the world, doesn't matter what area of life, really, that one is in. And all risk management is some kind of way of managing the relationship between the negative and positive sides of risk. Risk is inherently negative because it concerns consequences you want to avoid, but you must take those consequences into account if you want to achieve positive outcomes in your life. So whenever you form a relationship with another person, whenever you have a sexual encounter with another person, whenever you eat your breakfast, you're involved in an arena of risk taking, and we'll explore a bit more about those things later on in the lecture. Now, the rise of the idea of risk in Western society is also associated with the rise of the ideas of safety and security. You might think again, well, haven't these concepts always been around, but they haven't actually. The rise of the idea of risk goes along with a secular notion of safety and a secular notion of security. The reason being that in traditional cultures, either family or God or cosmological beliefs provided a framework of security for people, whatever security there was in traditional cultures. With the rise of the idea of risk, you get the idea that human beings should be responsible for their own safety, individually or collectively, that security should be provided actively, it doesn't just come from the world around us. That's why the early development of the welfare state is, which goes back to the Elizabethan poor laws at least, is about providing security for people. It's not just about regulating their behavior, it's about providing security. And the idea of security is inseparable from the notion of insurance. So the notion of insurance goes along with the idea of risk. And sociologists actually never taken much interest in insurance, but it is a fascinating thing because insurance is all about the management of time as well and the management of space. And we just assume in modern societies that you can get insured about almost anything, and normally you can. But it's only recently that this has been true. The idea of insuring against hazard presumes a notion of safety, presumes a notion of humanly engineered security. Well, even in many traditional cultures today, or in societies which are, as it were, on the edge of modernization, you find there are lots of things that you can't get insured for that in a Western country you would just assume that you could do. For example, people who went to Russia a few years ago were surprised to find that you can't insure your baggage if it's on a train. You can now, but you couldn't then if it's on a train journey. Why couldn't you insure it? Well, because if you lose your luggage, so what? You know, it's just these things happen. It's an act of God. I mean, that's how the world used to be. The idea that you can cover every risk is an extraordinarily odd idea, but really intriguing one once you start to think about it. Because I think the idea of covering risk, of having liability, the notion of liability is bound up with all these things, is somehow central to the attempt of Western society to control the world. You can't control what Western society wants to control unless you control the future, and you can't control the future unless you have some balance between risk and security, risk and safety, risk and insurance. Insurance, therefore, is, you have to understand, in a very broad sense, and actually the origins of insurance are very closely tied up with the origins of risk, because the first insurance companies were actually marine insurance companies. That's where Lloyd's insurance came from. They covered these adventurers as they went around the world and started to trade with people from alien cultures. So the idea of insurance also comes from seafaring, comes from exploration, comes from the need to inject some kind of systematic security into an inherently unstable environment. The more you confront the future, the more you see the future is open, the more you are forced to think in these terms of risk, liability, insurance. And as I'll be saying in a minute, this applies to personal decisions, not just to socially structured decisions. So the notion of risk, therefore, unlocks something about how modern society came to be as it is. But a key part of my argument I want to propose to you now is that in the 20th century, the late 20th century, the period I was talking about last time, the period of intensifying globalization, only something like last 30 or 40 years or so, the structure of risk environments has been changing. It's been changing largely through the impact of the globalizing forces that I discussed in the previous lecture. And I'd like to try to handle this change conceptually by making a distinction between what I call external risk, or if you like, external uncertainty, and what I call manufactured risk, or you could substitute manufactured uncertainty. Some people, following the economist Frank Knight, make a distinction between risk and uncertainty. A lot of economists like to think along those lines. Risk is supposedly something you can calculate. You can actually calculate the risk of, for example, achieving a certain outcome on a gambling table because you know what the parameters are. Uncertainty is where you can't make those calculations. However, if this distinction was ever appropriate and viable, which I don't think lots of people now think it wasn't, including me, it's become undermined by the transition from external to manufactured risk today. So I use risk and uncertainty as equivalent terms. The best way to explain the distinction between external manufactured risk or manufactured uncertainty is to look at what's happened to the physical world as a result of the impact of science and technology. Then you could say that up to about three or four decades ago, not long ago, that is up to the period of intensifying globalization, most of the risks which people were worried about from nature came from external nature. They were risks like risks of poor yield of harvest, natural climatic change, earthquakes, floods, plagues, whole diversity of risks coming from the natural world, never really understood by people and understood anyway in quasi-religious terms. So traditionally, people worried about the risks coming from the natural world understood as external to human society. Over the past 30 or 40 years, all this has started to change. At some point during that period, we started to worry much less about what nature can do to us and much more about what we've done to nature. That transition marks the rise of ecological politics and the rise of ecological concerns. When we start worrying about what we've done to nature, we're in the era of manufactured risk. Manufactured risk means human risk environments or human environments of uncertainty created by the very changes I discussed last time, partly by the very advance of science and technology themselves. Science and technology, as I mentioned last time, were supposed to conquer uncertainty. They have done in some domains and in some respects, but in others they've accentuated these uncertainties. So if you consider global warming, for example, there's massive controversy still about whether global warming really exists, about whether it's humanly produced or not, about what the level of risk actually is, about how many benign as well as malign consequences there will be. All this is a kind of open discussion environment. Most new risk situations of manufactured risk, look like this. Genetically modified foods, the BSE crisis, are other examples of contemporary discussions of manufactured risk. In these kinds of risk environments, as I'll suggest shortly, there are different kind of mechanisms of what risk is and how we should respond to it from those characteristic of the past. But definition of manufactured risk or manufactured uncertainty is that manufactured risk comes from human intervention, either in history or into nature through science and technology. Manufactured risk is the kind of discovery that a lot of areas of growth of human knowledge collapse in on us. You remember last time I mentioned that the old Enlightenment theorem about increasing knowledge about the world leading to increasing certainty, we've discovered that that is only partly true. The increasing intrusion of human knowledge into our own lives and into the world of nature actually creates new uncertainties, new risk environments, to which we have to respond differently from those characteristic of the past. One of the main reasons for the expanding entry of risk into our everyday lives, into the discourse of our everyday lives, is the prevalence of manufactured risk. It comes from two things, not just nature. One thing it does come from, which I was talking about, is the what some people call the end of nature. And I think that's quite a sort of useful phrase for what's happened over the past few years. The end of nature doesn't mean, of course, the natural world disappears or that physical processes disappear. It simply means that there are very few things in the external world, including the climate or physical geography, which are not influenced by human technology or by human impact in some way or another. The end of nature means the end of nature as natural, if you like. There are very few things any longer which are purely natural processes uninfluenced by human intervention in some way or another. Actually, our very absorption with natural foods, organically grown foods, the idea of returning to a natural kind of way of life is a sort of reaction to and bound up with the end of nature. You only start worrying about doing things, as it were, naturally when you see that the world of nature itself is becoming undermined and transformed irretrievably, because there's no going back to the past on this. The other process that's happening as a result of globalization, detraditionalization, is what you can call the end of tradition. I mean, these are gross phrases for complicated processes, but the end of tradition doesn't mean that traditions disappear any more than the end of nature means that the physical world disappears. End of tradition means that tradition shapes our lives less and less. Tradition and custom used to be like landscapes of activity. They still are in many traditional cultures, of course. If you think of a physical landscape of nature, it was a kind of external risk environment. Well, it's a kind of quasi-physical landscape of tradition, because tradition used to structure lots of decisions for us. What tradition does is that it takes decisions out of our own hands. That's what nature does, as anyone can see. For example, if you consider the field of reproduction, for thousands of years, people had only marginal control over reproductive processes. So if you're a woman, you were destined normally to a life of domesticity, having lots of children. Traditional cultures were always the case. Now, what we can do is we can allow people to decide when they have children, whether they have children at all, what the sex of the child would be. You can have a child without any sexual contact with another person whatsoever. Gay people can have their own children. You know, there are all these possibilities. All these involve new choices, where previously there were no choices. Whenever you have choice, you have risk, because whenever you have choice, you're confronting an open future. You're not just doing what was done in the past. You have to ask yourself, what kind of consequences am I prepared to envisage if I take this course of action? So the relaxation of tradition is really, you know, the other way of putting it is to say that the idea of fate is retreating further and further. The notion of risk is bound up with the retreat of the idea of fate. And for us, the idea of fate is receding further than it did for previous generations. You can see this in the changing nature of marriage in Western societies. A generation ago, marriage was largely structured by tradition and established ways of doing things. If you got married, it was like a kind of state of nature. Either you were married or you're not married. You're a spinster if you weren't married as a woman, a bachelor if you were not as a man. Now for us, a generation later, marriage has become largely detraditionalized. So when you meet another person, you want to be with that person, you have to make a decision really about whether you want to be married or not, whether you want to live that with that person, what kind of relationship you have with that person. You do so against the background of a kind of profusion of knowledge, because everybody knows that divorce rates are high, much higher than they were in the past. Everyone knows that women stake much more claim to autonomy and freedom. They want to be in the labor force like men. These things are simply different from the past, so the idea of risk, therefore, enters in centrally to these personal decisions as well. The institutions of marriage always involved you in risk, but the institutions, as it were, took care of a lot of those decisions for you, just like nature did, in a way, previously. Now, as we've kind of intervened in these things and we've opened them out to decision-making processes, the idea of risk always creeps in there. So the idea of manufactured risk is not limited to the natural world. It also is bound up with some of the profound changes going on in the social world, because globalization tends to de-traditionalize societies. And emancipatory political movements do as well, because the women's movement, for example, actively wanted a situation where women were able to decide more about their lives than they were in the past. And anyone who's either a woman or a man now knows that there's a strong mixture of emancipation and anxiety in such processes when tradition doesn't do the job for you. So you have to decide about so many things, about how to look, how to be, what kind of sexuality to have even, how you form relationships with other people, how you keep them going. These are all much more open and problematic questions for us than they were a generation ago, or they still are in many traditional cultures across the world. And when you have the rise of situations of manufactured risk, you have a range of new risk situations which we all have to face, which analyze out differently from risk situations in the past. In the past, what insurance companies did, and they still do when they cover risk, is they have an historical series of events. They calculate probabilities, and then they determine liability, in other words, how much you pay, on that basis. So every time you get into a car, an insurance company can calculate the chances of you being in an accident, being injured, or killed on the roads, because you have many cases, an historical series to go on. That's what actuarial science and probability science are all about. In the new risk situations, you can't make those calculations because they're on the frontiers of human experience, and you simply don't have the historical experience to go on to make probability calculations. So in the new risk situations, the very existence of risk is likely to be disputed. The experts will disagree. Decisions have to be made politically rather than left up to scientists or technical experts alone. And they intrude more and more into politics and the public domain. You follow the BSE crisis in this country is a perfect example of a new risk environment. Perfect example of the mistakes that governments can make, because the government at the time made the mistake of declaring that beef was safe. Well, no one even now knows that beef is safe. Well, I better not say this because this influences the beef industry, but you do not know because even the causality of BSE has not been finally established. We don't know whether it's a new disease or an old disease at the moment. The same thing applies with GM crops. We do not know how safe or otherwise they are. We can simply make reasonable inferences about it. So a government declares that simply these foods are safe is actually misleading the public, and politicians will have to get used to this new kind of moral climate of risk. Now, in this new moral climate of risk, you tend to get an oscillation, very interesting one, between accusations of scaremongering on the one hand and accusations of cover-ups on the other. And so far as I can tell, there is no completely rational way for a government or even for us in our everyday lives to extract ourselves from the dilemmas which this presents. The main reasons are the following. When a new risk is announced, say for example a new scientific finding about a particular foodstuff and its likely consequences for our health, if you're a government or if you're an individual consumer, you have to make a decision about it. Is beef safe to eat, for example? Should I still eat beef? Are other kinds of meat safe to eat? Are other kinds of foods, are genetically modified crops safe to eat? You can't know in advance because these new risk environments are different from the past. We don't have the material which can be given to you to make that decision. And the experts in new risk situations are always divided. So you might say, we want to turn to the experts. Well, you have to turn to the experts, but the experts will not give you a consensual answer because they don't know either. Because the environment of testing has not yet been developed sufficiently to determine in these particular cases. So if you announce the risk prematurely, and it turns out that the risk is less than was thought to be the case, you will be accused of scaremongering. And accusations of scaremongering are kind of rife, really, in the new moral climate of politics. On the other hand, if you get it wrong, and there turns out to be more risk than you supposed, or a risk when you were claiming that there was no risk at all, then you'll be accused of a cover-up. There's no way of extricating yourself in a rational way fully from the situation because nobody knows in advance. There is no one to turn to make the authoritative decisions. That means a new form of politics for us. It means that technology and science for us have become politicized in a way which was not true for previous generations. They've become politicized largely because as science and technology themselves become globalized, they impact on our lives much more quickly than they did before. You can't wait around, therefore, for scientists to make up their minds by a whole load of tests before you take decisions about what food to eat, for instance, because we've got to eat. And the foods we eat are now, you know, massively different from the foods that people ate a generation ago. But this is true of so many aspects of our environment have been changed by the impact of science, technology, human knowledge intensifying over this latter day period. This is a highly reflexive world, the world of late modernity, in which there's a lot of information around and in which reflecting on this information becomes constitutive of what you are as a human being, of your own identity. All of us, in some sense, have to decide what to eat. You cannot not be on a diet in Western culture because there is hardly any traditional foodstuffs produced in the traditional way anymore. Even organic foods are not actually produced in a traditional way. They're a kind of innovation, by and large. We're on a diet in the sense in which we have to choose what to eat amid a swirl of medical dietary information, which is changeable information. But you can't extricate yourself from that environment. You must take an attitude towards it. So people take different attitudes, I think. Some people give a lot of attention to what they eat and try to keep up, as it were, with new knowledge. Others say, well, how are you going to tell? Because it's all shifting. I mean, pasta made me fat yesterday, now it makes me thin. How am I supposed to relate to that? You know, when cigarettes were first marketed in the 1940s on a widespread basis, 1930s, 1940s, doctors recommended smoking as a pacifier, as a calmant. No one knew that smoking stored up these massive risks 20 or so years later for a smoking population. You can't know these things in advance. So this is a very difficult environment of action in which to operate. But its reflexive nature is much more important and intriguing than these examples indicate. Because what we're doing all the time, you might not know it, but what we're doing all the time is making risk assessments on an unconscious, habitual kind of basis in Western culture. And these decisions influence the risk environments themselves. And they can impact on, in all sorts of paradoxical ways, upon scaremongering versus cover-ups. Take the example of AIDS and propagation of knowledge about AIDS in Western society. You propagate knowledge about AIDS and you scare people about certain kinds of sexual practices in order to get them to change their behavior. Now let's suppose, as was the case for a while in many gay communities particularly, people do change their behavior. Well then the incidence of AIDS turns out to be much lower than was originally predicted. And so the people who originally predicted them are called scaremongers, even though scaremongering was the condition of producing the reduction that made them seem like scaremongers. So that kind of reflexive involvement with risk environments is characteristic of how we live. It's entered into the very tissue of what we do and who we are. This means that the idea of objective risk management risk assessment is much more difficult than turns out at first sight because of its reflexive component. Take statistics on crime as an example. Many criminologists and scientific experts and politicians say that old people living in city centres are wrong to worry about crime and the fear of violent crime because most violent crime affects younger people. You can show this statistically. The risk of being involved in violent crime is much higher if you're a young man, especially living and interacting in a city centre, than it is if you're an older person. So it seems as though the older people are being irrational because they're simply ignorant of the true objective risk which they face. But actually, this is not so, because what this misses out is the reflexive component, Most older people know something about city environments. They know that some environments are dangerous. Therefore, they don't get out after hours. They don't go down certain streets. They don't go into parks after a certain time. So that their knowledge of risk is actually changing the very definition of the risk environment. And this is characteristic of so many environments of risk in contemporary times. One of the best examples of reflexivity and risk is actually in financial markets, with the kinds of things that Nick Leeson was dabbling in, so-called derivatives. Derivatives are simply risk folded on risk folded on risk, but where everybody is making reflexive calculations of the risks that other people are making reflexive calculations about. That's why financial markets are so complicated. Everybody is making risk assessments, which involve making assessments and judgments about other people's risk assessments. That's why you could never get complete knowledge of a financial market by definition, because the reflexive component is central. All of this leaves us, therefore, in a very interesting relationship to science and technology. And in closing, I'd just like to suggest that our relationship to science and technology has changed, because in the new open risk environments, in the more reflexive culture in which we now live, we're in a continuous dialogue with science and technology in a way which wasn't true before. We're in a dialogue with science and technology because of the immediacy of their impact upon our lives and because of the pervasive nature of that impact. That dialogue takes the form of a kind of political dialogue, because you have to make decisions, whether you're a consumer or an individual or a government, in relation to contested risk environment. The experts don't agree because of the newness of the consequences of the phenomena involved. So if you consider diet, for example, so many controversies about what food is actually healthy for you and what is not. And as I said right at the beginning, this is liable to change over time. So what happens to all of us is that we're all involved in an everyday debate which once upon a time was simply limited to the philosophers. The most famous philosopher at the LSE, Karl Popper, analyzed out the nature of science. And he argued that, contrary to what most people think, science is not about certainty. Science is about uncertainty, which brings it close to risk. Science, as Popper argued, is about being able to knock down hypotheses rather than confirm hypotheses. It's not about proof, it's about disproof. Science is essentially a critical attitude towards the world in which you're prepared to revise even your most cherished beliefs. Well, what's happening in contemporary culture is that we are now all in contact with the skeptical, changeable, mutable nature of scientific activity. What used to be a matter for the philosophers of science is now a matter for all of us in our everyday behavior, because any area of our lives, whether it's food or it's climate or it's financial markets or it's other kinds of risk environments, are in this kind of open-ended dialogue where there is no expert of all experts to turn to, and where therefore we have to make existential decisions and governments and policymakers have to make value-laden decisions. That leads us, you know, to the question of whether you could have an effective democratization of science and technology. Because I think you could argue that the impact of science and technology in our lives is probably much greater than anything which is simply decided directly by political leaders. Science and technology are so profound now, they're so radical in their consequences, that have enormous consequences for our lives. I mean, I never asked to have to have a computer on my desk or to have a telephone answering machine, but you know, once you're in the environment of action, this is how we live. Well, none of us voted on such things, so far as I know. Can you democratize science and technology? Well, I think the answer is, to some degree you can, or to some degree you must. That is, if you consider the two key examples in this country, GM Foods and BSC Episode, those were not handled within a democratic framework. If you can have a democratic framework for reacting to science and technology, you need continuous monitoring of scientific and technological change. You need a mixture of scientists, lay people, politicians, maybe lawyers, meeting together regularly to assess the nature of the risks we face and our responses to them. And you probably need an institution in which to do this. Well, this could kind of bring you back to contemporary politics, because
You could argue, well, we're looking for something the House of Lords to do. Well, reconstitute the House of Lords could be one of the places where such decisive issues are actively discussed and debated publicly. Anyway, well, thanks again for coming. Look forward to seeing you, I hope, Wednesday next week.